You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
A trip to the doctor's office or hospital can be filled with all kinds of anxieties, from uncertainty with what's wrong with you to confusion over how to engage with your doctor about it. Dr. Lena Wen and Joshua Jasowski have written a new guidebook for navigating today's medical system and to make sure that you're diagnosed with the right illness. It's called When Doctors Don't Listen, How to Avoid Misdiagnoses and Unnecessary Tests. It is published by Thomas Dunn Books, and I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Lena Wen, who is an attending physician and director of patient-centered care research at George Washington University, back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Your book is very critical of what you call cookbook medicine. What's that?
Let me ask you if you've ever had this experience. You go to see your doctor. You tell the doctor that you have a specific complaint, like chest pain. And instead of asking you more to describe what that chest pain feels like, the doctor says, all right, let's do some tests. That's cookbook medicine. That's not personalizing medicine to you, but rather doing the same test, no matter who you are, based on your complaint only.
Is it different if I go to a doctor's office or if I go to a hospital?
Same idea, that cookbook medicine could be practiced anywhere.
Is this because you were trained as a doctor to arrive at quick diagnoses or to avoid coming up with a quick diagnosis in this case?
I'm an emergency physician, and we need to come up with quick diagnoses and quick plans and quick treatments because the person in front of us could have a life-threatening illness. But this is actually the opposite of getting to the diagnosis. It's actually doing the same things regardless of what that final outcome might even be.
But I've also had the other experience, and not me, but a close friend who went to a number of doctors with a condition, and they would go down a little checklist. And because she didn't have the right number of symptoms, they misdiagnosed her. She had a condition that eventually somebody figured out she had to be treated for. But if she only had six of the symptoms instead of seven, they dismissed the possibility that it could be what she had.
It would be wonderful if all of our patients came in as a textbook, that if everything that we learn in medical school is exactly textbook perfect. But people are complicated. We have so many other things that may contribute to our illness, including what we eat and where we live and what our genetic illnesses are and how we communicate. And all of these things have to be taken into consideration, too.
You write that your mother's cancer diagnosis gave you a whole new understanding of what it meant to be a patient. How did your perspective on medicine change?
When I was a second-year medical student, my mother was misdiagnosed for over a year before she was finally diagnosed with what turned out to be metastatic cancer. Her doctor had done tests looking for anemia, had told her that she was depressed and put her on Prozac and anti-anxiety medications. And through that process, I saw how disempowered patients can feel in the act of receiving medical care, and what we as doctors also have to do better in getting that story from our patients.
So how did they finally come up with the right diagnosis?
She was so ill at that point that she was coughing up blood and could barely walk up the stairs. And at that point, she was diagnosed. But I would argue that that diagnosis should have been made a lot sooner. And I'll say, too, that as a physician now, I miss diagnoses all the time. And I want patients to be able to help me do my job better and help me help them.
We hear from doctors that the problem is malpractice lawsuits and high insurance, and that's why the way medicine is practiced has changed over the years.
Certainly it's a problem. Malpractice is a problem in emergency medicine. We think about it all the time, but I think there's an even bigger problem, which is that we in medicine reward doing more to people rather than for them. Instead of saying, let's actually work on listening to patients and reimbursing for time spent with patients, we reimburse for procedures done to patients, which isn't actually helping with the diagnosis at the end of the day.
Is there an insurance incentive to approach it that way?
The way our reimbursement system works in this country, based on the way that our policies are formulated, is that we are reimbursed for procedures. And yet we know that 80% of all diagnoses can be made just based on listening, just based on the history. So if we're not listening, how are we getting that right?
Has the Affordable Care Act changed any of that, or is it still business as usual?
I would like to be an optimist and say that the Accountable Care Act offers some incentives for us to get to the right diagnosis, but it remains to be seen how that will actually play out.
But getting back to malpractice, you write, doctors profess servile adherence to rules and recipes that they believe will protect them from malpractice lawyers. Fear of missing a serious diagnosis, however improbable, dominates medical decision-making to the exclusion of common sense and the patient's best interests.
Studies have shown that the number one contributor to medical malpractice is not trying to get all these checklists and things done, but rather lack of communication. And so if a doctor is doing checklist of things but not explaining to the patient what's happening and not listening to the patient to get to the right diagnosis, then that's what's going to lead to malpractice.
Now, of course, checklists come from all of the work that has been done before, all the research that's been done before. Isn't that a good way to go about things?
There is definitely a role for a checklist. So if I were getting a surgical procedure done, I want to make sure that my surgeon washes his or her hands, that no sponges are left in my body, that everything is done correctly. But checklists used for diagnosis could be dangerous because, again, people are not textbooks. And if you enter in abdominal pain into the internet, you might find out as a male that you could be pregnant. I mean, there are all kinds of things that aren't correct if you just use checklists for diagnosis.
On the other hand, checklists are based on empirical evidence, aren't they?
Checklists can be useful for treatment, for empirical evidence, but for diagnosis, I still contend that we have studies all the way back from the 50s until current day saying that the number one contributor to accurate diagnosis is the history rather than a checklist of symptoms.
I'm talking with Lena Wen, who with Joshua Kosowski has written a book called When Doctors Don't Listen, How to Avoid Misdiagnoses and Unnecessary Tests. Why, when doctors don't listen, is that a common problem? You're a doctor. Do you find that your colleagues don't listen?
Doctors don't listen, not because we don't want to listen, but because of the pressures on our time. And that's what we wanted to communicate in our book, that it's a combination of the pressures in the system and how we're trained that doctors these days are not listening as we should be and as our patients deserve and as we want to. So we want our patients to help us become better listeners.
You emphasize that it's important for a patient to ask for a diagnosis. I'd assume that when I go to a doctor, it's implied that I'm going there for a diagnosis.
That's right. And yet doctors have gotten away from the idea of providing a diagnosis and instead saying, let me rule out all the bad things that are going on with you, which is important, but not the only reason you're going to see the doctor.
And you write, watch out if your doctor gives you a diagnosis that sounds like a symptom.
That's
right.
Can
you give me an example?
Let's say that you go to the doctor saying that you have abdominal pain, and the doctor says to you at the end of the day, you don't have appendicitis, you don't have a gallbladder infection, you have abdominal pain. But what does that mean? I mean, maybe the doctor doesn't know. That's okay. But the doctor should still express that uncertainty to you and help you figure out what to do from that point onward.
How can they find out if they don't do the test then?
By listening, again, because we know that the major contributor to accurate diagnosis is the history. If 80% comes from the history, then tests can only contribute to an additional 20% of all things done.
You write that it's very important to tell your whole story at the doctor's office. What kind of details do patients often omit?
It's difficult to know how much of the story to tell, but what I would say in telling your story is pretend that you're not talking to your doctor. Let's say that you're talking to your friend, your sister, your mother, and you're telling them about what's going on with you. Use that same language, and in particular, talk about the context of your life and how that's affected you. So instead of saying, I have a headache that's 10 out of 10, I don't know what that means to you to have a 10 out of 10 headache, but what if you said, my headache has been so bad for the last 3 days that I haven't been able to get out of bed and go to work? That tells me
a lot
more.
And what would that tell you?
That tells me that this is really affecting your life. And if you have a history of migraines, and this is not how your normal migraines present, that makes me much more worried that something else is going on.
Well, doctors are under a lot of pressure to see as many patients as possible. Shouldn't a patient be concise, knowing that there are all those other people in the waiting room?
I believe so, yes. And that is one way of helping your doctor help you. One thing that I tell my patients and patient advocacy groups when I speak with them is be prepared when you come to the doctor. Know your own medical history and know also the statistic that doctors won't interrupt you in 10 seconds after you start speaking. So get your point across quickly.
That is a problem sometimes. The doctor interrupts you to ask you a question. You lose your train of thought.
Right. And so prepare in advance, write down the key points, and make sure that you communicate these key points as you're talking to your doctor.
We would like to open this up to listener phone calls. If you have a question about how to interact with your doctor, give us a call at 212-433-9692, or you can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. You can also send us a question over Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. You also emphasize using simple language. Why should we avoid medicalese at the doctor's office? Isn't it good to talk to the doctor on the doctor's own terms?
You might think so, but most of the time when doctors hear you speaking in medicalese, they think that you're pretending to be something you're not. It's much better to relate it to your own body. So instead of saying, I have epigastric pain, the doctor doesn't know whether you know what epigastric pain really is. So if you said, I have pain right in the middle of my stomach, right underneath my chest, and point to it, that's going to be a lot more descriptive.
I'm sure that that often comes from someone looking up the problem on the internet first, and they come up with the medical term and think, well, when they talk to the doctor, they're talking to the doctor. They're giving the doctor more information than they might be giving otherwise.
That's right. I believe it all comes from good intention, but there is a way to do this correctly, and there's a way to do it wrong.
And so many people have told me that when they go to the internet and look up their symptoms, they always come away feeling that they have cancer or some other major serious problem. They're going to die in 2 weeks.
I think the internet can be great for many things, and in particular, it's good for figuring out treatment. So if you're already given a diagnosis, figuring out what to expect and knowing what questions to ask is helpful, but it's not so great for diagnosis.
You mentioned that you probably shouldn't say, I have a 10 out of 10 headache, but doctors often ask us to rate pain on a scale from 1 to 10.
Or nurses do, because that is one of the metrics that hospitals often use. If they ask you a direct question, I'd recommend answering it. But when you're communicating pain, when you're communicating your symptoms, for instead of saying, I have bad shortness of breath, what if you said, I can't breathe even to the point that I can't walk from my bed to the bathroom? That would tell the doctor a lot more than, I have trouble breathing.
Let's take a call from Bob from Rego Park. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing, Leonard? Great show as usual. My question is this, you know, you go into an emergency room, there's 40 people there, you see the doctor, he or she is in a hurry. Recently in New York City, it was a young man who in a gym class fell on the floor, went to emergency room, went home, went back to emergency room, and ended up dying two times in emergency room. How would you have handled that procedure, and how do you get the doctors, including yourself, to slow down in the emergency room?
That's an excellent question, Bob. I mean, I work in an emergency room as well, and I can tell you that on an average 8-hour shift, I can see 40, 50, 60 critically ill patients, and there is very limited time. What I would recommend, I mean, I don't know the specific circumstance, but what I would recommend is explain to the doctor exactly what happened. Don't hold back. If there's something you're worried about, or if you're taking a friend or family member in, if there's something that you're worried about, for example, you could say, my friend is just not acting his normal self. Normally, he'll be talking to you. Now, he can't even remember his birth date. That's something that would really get the doctor's attention. So get across what is it that you're worried about, and don't leave until you get an answer.
Early in the book, you write about a patient named Danielle LaConte, a 20-year-old college student in Boston. Why did she wind up in the emergency room?
I read about Danielle, who had a lot to drink the night before, a lot of alcohol to drink, and she basically woke up with a hangover headache, but was scared. I mean, her family wasn't around. She didn't know what to do with this headache. She never really had a hangover before. She shows up in the ER with this headache, mainly to feel better. But she tells someone, we don't know who, but the triage nurse or someone, that she has the worst headache of her life, which then leads her to get a CT scan. Then she's told that she needs to get a spinal tap. And she gets actually so scared that she jumps out the window of the bathroom. Now, I have to clarify that it's a first floor window and she's fine. She didn't commit suicide. I mean, somebody asked me about this the other day and I said, no, it wasn't that severe. But this had to do with people not taking into account her story, and maybe also her not explaining, too, what is it that led her to come to the ER.
Doctors Lena Nguyen and Joshua Kosowski have written a book called When Doctors Don't Listen, How to Avoid Misdiagnoses and Unnecessary Tests. It is published by Thomas Dunn Books. We will continue our conversation. Take your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or tweet us at hashtag Leonard Lopate. We're back with Dr. Lena Nguyen, a co-author of When Doctors Don't Listen, How to Avoid Misdiagnoses and Unnecessary Tests. She is an attending physician and director of patient-centered care research at George Washington University. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or tweet us at Leonard Lopate. And Benny from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Hello.
Yes, Benny.
Yes, just curious about misdiagnoses, and if, do we have any statistics or information on how many diagnoses turn out to be misdiagnoses?
Benny, that's an excellent question. To my knowledge, there are many different estimates of misdiagnoses. I'll give you a couple. So we know that every year, at least 100,000 people die from medical error. And the number one cause of fatal medical error is misdiagnosis, which makes sense because if your diagnosis is wrong in the first place, then so is everything else that follows. My mother passed away, unfortunately, a few years ago, and her death in part was because her diagnosis was so delayed. And so it's hard to know exactly how many misdiagnoses there are. But I would say is that sometimes your diagnosis, your initial diagnosis may not be correct. That may be okay because it's hard to know what it is in that moment, but it's important to know how to fix it from that point onward.
Don't misdiagnoses often follow a patient? I know somebody who had endometriosis, but the first doctor who saw her decided it was PID, and she was treated for PID, including being given antibiotics, which she did not need. When she got out of the hospital, it recurred. They were going to give her a hysterectomy to cure the PID, which was incurable. And then finally, after 2 years, a doctor said, you have endometriosis, which is a totally different condition, not unusual. And when she was treated for it in late stages, it was a lot more difficult, but she finally got past it.
That's a great example, and that's why I tell patients it's important to review your own medical record. Ask for a copy of your medical record, because what you might see is something like this, an old diagnosis that's not correct, or often women in particular will see a psychiatric diagnosis on their medical record that may influence their care, the depression, the anxiety, fibromyalgia, things that may actually confound the accurate diagnosis later on.
Then often doctors suggest that maybe it's your fault that this thing is persisting when you've been misdiagnosed from the start.
Mm-hmm.
And a listener wonders, how do you find a doctor who will listen to you? Because that is a problem in many cases. Some doctors just really do want to act like they are God.
I'd say two things. The first is make sure that you give your doctor a chance. There are many patients who don't necessarily want a partnership with their doctor. And your doctor may assume that you just want a doctor who tells you what to do. And so give your doctor a chance and say, I believe in a partnership. I believe that I'm the expert when it comes to my body and you're the expert when it comes to medicine. Let's partner together for that care.
If we think a diagnosis is wrong, should we tell the doctor?
I would state it as a question. You could say, for example, I don't understand this diagnosis. From what I understand of it, these are the symptoms that I should be having. So, for example, the doctor says, you have heartburn. And you say, but I don't understand. I thought heartburn, mainly I should have burping and some gas feeling. But how does that explain the headache and the vomiting that I'm having? And that could help the doctor think of, well, maybe there's something else that I should expand that diagnosis to. If you really find that your doctor isn't listening, try to find someone else. And I always find that word of mouth is a helpful way of getting a good doctor who listens.
And a listener, in fact, asked, how do we know when we should get a second opinion? When we're frustrated by the way the doctor is dealing with us?
When you don't think that your doctor is willing to listen and get you the right diagnosis, then that's the time to get a second opinion. And I would say don't wait. And if you get a second opinion, try to get a second opinion that's impartial. Because otherwise, if they're in the same practice as the doctor from before, it's possible that they'll just look at that other doctor's chart and not start from scratch as they should.
Let's take another call. Susan from Westchester. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I'd like to give an example of how diagnosis skills without tests are very important. When my daughter was about 7, she had had severe stomach problems for about 3-4 days. She wasn't eating or drinking. We took her to the emergency room, and they conducted all sorts of tests, CAT scans, blood tests, everything else. They said, this is not appendicitis. She has gastroenteritis, but we're just going to admit her just for observation. As soon as they put her up on the pediatric floor, the pediatric hospitalist examined her and immediately got very, very worried. Now, this was a doctor, an older doctor who was trained in the Ukraine, probably without access to a lot of the sophisticated tests. And she just manipulated her legs and, you know, did this and that with her belly and immediately said, I don't agree with the ER. I'm getting the surgeon up here. And sure enough, turns out that not only did she have appendicitis, but she had a ruptured appendix.
You gave a fantastic example, Susan, of the limitations of testing. We like to think in our society now that if you get a CAT scan or an MRI, that it's going to give all the answers that you can possibly want. But we forget that tests are not 100%, that we have to rely on clinical acumen. And I personally get very worried about medical training. You mentioned this Ukrainian doctor who was trained somewhere else and maybe may understand the physical exam better. I worry about what we're doing with our medical students such that they're forgetting how to take a history, how to do a good physical exam, and instead rely on tests, which, as you said, are not 100% right.
Do you think that some doctors might need retraining on how to talk to their patients?
I also think doctors need training in the first place, that we're not doing a good enough job with our medical students, and in particular, not having them watch master doctors, which is something that certainly if you're out in training, that's something that doesn't happen either.
I saw something ironic in what Susan said there. We are very proud of the fact that we have more advanced medicine than people in other countries, especially in countries in the former Soviet Union. And yet there's still something to be said for old-fashioned doctoring.
Absolutely. Abraham Verghese writes about the physical exam that is just not taught and not understood nowadays and how we need to bring back, really, this art of medicine. But I don't even think it's just the art of medicine. We tend to separate art and science as if they're to the exclusion of each other. But part of the art of medicine is understanding how important listening is to the diagnosis. And so how do we teach that and make sure that tomorrow's doctors are just as capable as yesterday's doctors?
I'm talking with Dr. Lena Nguyen, who with Dr. Joshua Kosowski have written When Doctors Don't Listen, How to Avoid Misdiagnoses and Unnecessary Tests. It's published by Thomas Dunn Books. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692, or you can write us online at WNYC.org. Let's go to Serena. Hi, Serena. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'm calling because I'm a physician, and I'm a primary care physician. And when I was working in the clinics, what I found is that you did not have enough time to talk to your patients because you were overbooked. That means you had several patients booked in one particular slot, thinking that somebody may drop out or not come in. And the idea was that since the clinic was getting paid less per patient by insurance companies, that they had to have more patients coming through. So you used to have time to talk to your patient, and now you're restricted to maybe 10 minutes to talk to a patient. Or someone else will interview the patients for you, but you miss that face-to-face contact with the person and those nuances that can give you clues as to what's going on with them. I would like your comments on this, and I'll be off the air. Thank you.
And I've seen that in emergency rooms where a nurse asks you all the questions, and then the doctor comes over and looks at what's been written down, and suddenly you're being treated, even though you might have other things to tell that doctor.
That's right. Or maybe you even had a number of tests that were ordered even before you saw the doctor at all. And I understand that some of that is the pressures in our healthcare system. And Serena, you're 100% right that this is a huge problem. And as a physician yourself, you know that this is not what any of us want as doctors either. There is a role to be to play in what I call slow medicine, right? That maybe we should slow down and really listen and focus on observation and not just rush to get tests, all of which have potentially negative consequences too.
On the other hand, some nurses will tell you that they understand what's going on better than some of the doctors who come by.
This is certainly not to say that nurses should not be talking to patients or that we should not be working as a team. In fact, I actually think that nurses are much better trained than doctors in how to listen and how to practice compassionate care. But rather, I think it's a statement about our whole healthcare system that we're just not doing a good enough job in paying attention to what it means to be a caring provider.
A listener wondered whether certain people are more likely to be misdiagnosed than others, Native Americans, African Americans, women.
There are some studies that have shown that women, African Americans, people who for whom English is their second language, tend to be misdiagnosed. And that may be in part because of cultural barriers. That, for example, my mother, she was so scared of speaking up to her doctor. I remember very vividly her telling me when we were waiting in the waiting room to go in, she asked me not to speak up, because she was so afraid of my challenging the doctor, like Elaine Seinfeld. She was afraid of being fired by her doctor. And that's such
even though you're a doctor.
That's right. But it's such a common perception by patients, especially those who may be more disadvantaged, that there will be some negative repercussions if they speak up. But I would say it's exactly the opposite. It's exactly these patients who need to help to advocate for themselves.
We go now to Frank. Hi, Frank. You're on the air. Frank from West Babylon.
Hi, Leonard. How are you?
Okay.
I have a quick question. I was sent to the hospital a few years ago. I had a very high fever, about 104, 105 fever. The doctor sent me to the hospital. He was afraid I had some type of, I don't know, a tumor, a cyst, or something of this nature in my sinuses, and he wanted a CAT scan done. So he sent me to the hospital. To this day, my doctor has yet to call me back and say, hey, Frank, how'd it work out at the hospital? Now, my girlfriend is a veterinarian, and she calls her patients back constantly. If she does a surgery, she'll call them back the next day and say, how's Muffy doing? If she, you know, gives them a vaccine, she'll call them up and say, how is he doing with the food? Should we expect this from human doctors, or is this just something like some sick romantic fantasy I have?
You should have barked at your doctor, obviously.
I should have, Leonard. I should have.
This is the way that medicine used to be practiced. And I hate to romanticize the way that things were, because there are a lot of great advances that we now have in medicine. I don't want to be living 100 years ago before antibiotics and x-rays and so forth. But it used to be that you had your doctor. If you're in the hospital, your doctor comes and sees you. Your doctor calls you the next day and asks you how you're doing. Your doctor sets up appointments with you for other people to see. And our system now has become so uncoordinated that there's not one person who's in charge of your health. Now, you mentioned the Affordable Care Act earlier, and that's one thing that the Affordable Care Act is trying to change. And with the ACA and other legislation, that's something that ideally we can start having more coordination and care.
Leslie from the Upper West Side. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. I have cystic fibrosis, and I'm a lot more complicated than the average patient. In fact, I was misdiagnosed my entire life until the age of 45, which is a whole other story. I have some liver issues that I'm facing. An MRI indicated cirrhotic tissue. My doctor is suggesting having an invasive procedure, a liver biopsy, into that tissue. And my question is, if that procedure yields any information, but the fact is that I'm not going to be doing anything differently than the medication that I'm already taking, what's the point of doing something like this to refine the diagnosis?
It's a great point, and actually I had a very similar situation happen with my husband. A couple years ago, he had a rash on his arm that wouldn't go away, and initially we thought that this was poison ivy. It was itchy. He took some steroids. He went to see a dermatologist, and dermatologist said, let's do a biopsy of your skin. And my question for the dermatologist was exactly what you're saying, which is, how is this going to change his management? If he's still going to try some steroid creams, if he's still going to try some other medications, and it doesn't matter what the biopsy shows, the management is not going to change. And so I would say, if you're being offered a test, always ask not just what are the risks and benefits, but also what happens if I don't do it? Am I going to die? I mean, what's going to happen? And also, how is this going to change my management going forward?
You write that we should never leave a doctor's office without at least a working diagnosis.
A working diagnosis is the most likely thing that you may have, and it may be two or three things that you may have, but it is not chest pain if you came in with chest pain, or a headache if you came in with a headache. You should have some idea of what it is that you have so that you can know what to do from that point onward. Should you get a test? Should you do a treatment? Are you going to be okay? Can you go to work? These are all things that your doctor should tell you, and if they don't, ask for it.
And again, this is a matter of being assertive in a situation where we often feel a little intimidated.
That's right. And know that your doctor actually wants to tell you. There is a lot in medicine that goes against the doctor wanting to be uncertain. And by saying to your doctor, I want to know, even if you're not 100% sure, it gives your doctor permission to practice medicine in the way that they want to practice medicine as well.
Dr. Lena Nguyen, co-author with Joshua Kozowski, also a doctor. When doctors don't listen to your colleagues, get upset when they know you've written a book like this?
You know, I've been surprised. I remember the first time that I handed a manuscript of this book to my chair, and I thought I might get fired, I might hear all kinds of things, maybe I'll be told not to write this book. I was surprised because this book reflects the frustrations that all of us feel in the medical profession. And what I want to emphasize is that we're all in this together. We're all part of an imperfect system, and doctors and patients together have to figure out how can we partner to get better medical care. And while systems changes are happening, what are the things that we can do in order to ensure that we help doctors help patients?
When Doctors Don't Listen, How to Avoid Misdiagnoses and Unnecessary Tests, written by Dr. Lena Nguyen, who's been our guest, and her colleague Joshua Kozowski, published by Thomas Dunn Books. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you very much.